Sometimes you choose courage, and at other times it's forced upon you. Courage Unraveled is a podcast series where you get to listen to insights, discussions, conversations, and stories from people from all walks of life. You'll be served with dollops of courage, resilience, and strength here. So come along and be educated and inspired. You just may find new ways to flex your own courage muscle. My name is Sana Turnock, and I'm your host. Today, we enter the world of psychologist Steph Schmidt and her experience with postnatal depression, not just once, but twice. Postnatal depression doesn't discriminate, even when you've been trained with tools and strategies at your fingertips. Steph talks about her time and what has helped her move through the challenges that postnatal depression brings. We also talk about what it's like to be a rural psychologist in isolated communities and be 2020 AgriFutures Rural Women's Award winner during COVID-19. Come and join us. It's a real privilege to be able to share these inspiring podcasts of courage with you. The work undertaken takes many hours to put together and is self-funded. Become a Courage Unraveled patron on Patreon, and not only will you be supporting the podcast, you will also be helping yourself by investing in your own courage. Get access to pre-release episodes and patron-only specials. It's easy being a patron, and the first tiers are less than 2 coffees per month. Cultivate and flex your courage muscle by signing up for a one-to-one Grow Into My Courage program and grab your very own journal. You grow your courage muscle by activating it. Listen to the podcasts, grab yourself the courage journal, sign up to the Grow Into My Courage program, and become a patron. After this episode, head over to courageunraveled.com. It's all happening there. Grow into your courage today. Steph Schmidt, welcome to Courage Unraveled.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. I love that you are a rural psychologist, a farmer, and South Australia's 2020 AgriFutures Rural Women's Award winner. What a tongue twister. Something positive turned out for you in 2020.
Yes, it did. It was a pretty exciting year. The announcement was literally in the beginning of March. I found out I was the winner, and then the world gradually changed day by day. But in a way, it worked out very well for me to have COVID happen, because I also had a baby halfway through last year as well. And then because of COVID, the award program got extended into 2021. So it all worked out kind of in my favour, I guess. A silver COVID lining for me.
I guess if there wasn't COVID, you would have to have been moving around the place, around the state probably, and doing face-to-face presentations, yeah, whereas I imagine you were doing a lot of online things. Would that be fair to say?
Yeah, it opened up scope for kind of shifting to online. And even just in terms of the award program, I would have had to be trying to decide whether I could travel at 36 weeks pregnant or with a 6 week old. And yeah, all of that. I didn't have to make any of those choices. So it worked out all right.
Oh, wow. That's amazing. Look, you wanted to share and chat about how it's okay not to be okay and to know that you're good enough. To me, this takes a level of awareness, strength, and definitely self-compassion. So are you okay if we start off by talking about postnatal depression, because it's an important topic?
Yeah, absolutely. It definitely is an important topic.
Okay. So you've experienced this twice. Could you describe what it was like the first time?
That was when my son, he's now 6, so he was a sparkler from the moment he was born. I had 7 months of barely any sleep at all. And thinking back to that time, really what I remember, he was very active. Once he was 7 months, he was crawling as well, and just kind of almost lying there on the floor while he would just crawl around me in circles, and just finding it really hard to know what to do, getting caught in that endless loop of motherhood, I guess, of the changing feeding, trying to get a baby to sleep, only to have them wake up very soon afterwards. And I guess just feeling very isolated as well.
Sometimes it's a real sense of loneliness, isn't it? Especially when it's your first time.
Yeah. And I guess for us on the farm, my husband has always worked very long hours on the farm. He would help out when he could, but it was very much both trying to do our own things and him keeping the farm going while I'm keeping life going at home. And not so easy to just going to town to catch up with people or heading along to a mum's group meeting kind of ends up taking the whole day. So, yeah, it was a real challenge.
I couldn't believe this when I read this, but you live in a place called World's End.
Yeah.
Like that blew me away. Is it true that it has a population of 7?
Probably would be closer to 5. It's really pretty much our family. We do have a workman who, 7 might be on the mark. We've got a workman and then a neighbour who comes from time to time. But we're about 20 kilometres from our closest main town of Burrough, which I don't even know the population there would maybe be about 1,000. Not huge either, but
right.
It feels bigger than here.
And if you needed to go see an allied health professional, for example, would you be going to Burrough or would you be travelling further to see your community health nurse or a psychologist or mental health professional?
Yeah, travelling further. So when I was seeing a psychologist, I went to the Barossa, which is probably about an hour and 20 minutes from us. And then when I was working as a psychologist, I was based in Clare, which is about 50 minutes or an hour or so. But for me, I guess it was travelling in the other direction so as not to be seeing my colleagues almost in a way.
This is one of the things that you just have to really consider and except when you're living rurally, right? And that's, I can imagine that's what you had to do.
Yeah, I think you just get used to doing it and get used to driving. I remember when other people, particularly friends in the city, have their babies and they go, they just don't like being in the car. I kind of go, well, I don't really get a choice. They're in the car no matter what. And yeah, it's kind of that juggle between needing to have a day out and go and do something, but then it's the whole day gone. Probably this time around, because my son's at school in Burrough, my oldest, and then my middle ones at childcare. So you've kind of got that heading out of the house every day, whether you like it or not. You do kind of get used to not being able to just do quick trips anywhere.
I lived in a place that took an hour to get to, a population town of about 80,000, so I understand what it was like. But we didn't have a population of 7, it was about 500, yeah. But still similar. Do you think that with your psychology background that you had some strategies to help yourself along, or were you actually feeling a bit out of your depth?
A bit of both, even though I could see the signs, probably kept trying to fight it, knowing those thoughts around I should know better or I should be able to do this, and probably also high expectations on myself as a parent. So kind of have all the research and understanding of what good enough parenting should look like. And then when you feel like you're failing at that, you tend to kind of beat yourself up even more. It probably has been a case in both times of, yes, I might know the strategies of what can help, but really needed to link into someone outside of that to actually help guide me. And also a little bit of that external reminder, hey, Steph, what you're going through at the moment is okay as well.
To be able to share your story just with someone who is a professional who you could relate to as well, I think that would be helpful for you too, yeah, because you're talking woman to woman in that situation.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's something this time around with Darcy, when I kind of really could see at about 3 months old that I was starting to kind of veer into postnatal depression land again. I went, right, let's get as many resources in. So I actually linked in with PANDA, the Perinatal Anxiety and Depression Alliance. I'm not quite sure of what it stands for, but the PANDA helpline. And that was great. They had some trained counsellors, but also almost that peer support where they'd just ring and check in. I probably wasn't the ideal patient and didn't end up sticking it through ideally, but it was good just to have that space to share my experience.
So is PANDA a rural-based helpline or?
No, it's a national scheme. And I think that's the thing. There's quite a few services out there, but it's just realising that a lot of the time people don't actually know what's available.
This is very true. Look, we're just going to change gears a little bit. In the information that you sent me, you mentioned leaning into discomfort. So during the intense times of postnatal depression, did you actually catch yourself and remember to do that?
It's an ongoing thing that I have to remember to do, probably both times around, but the current time is more vivid in my mind. I remember when Darcy was about 3-4 months old, and with 3 kids, it just all being hectic and busy and so much going on, it was just this real feeling of just wanting to get away from them all, just wanting to escape for a bit. And it is that reminder of actually being able to take a breath and lean in I sometimes think about it. Both my oldest kids went through biting stages when they'd bite. And I had a friend say to me, oh, the worst thing you can do when you're being bitten is to pull away from it. You almost actually have to push in and lean into the bite. And that's sometimes in really kind of uncomfortable situations, what I remember, like, this is painful, I don't like it. But by leaning into it, it almost provides that space instead of getting caught in that avoidance mode of, I don't want to be here, I don't want to do this, I want to get away from it. Then by leaning in, it gives that space to really kind of do what's most important. It's about acknowledging that this stuff shows up, whether we want it to be there or not. And when we kind of lean into the moment, then we can almost make space for it rather than getting caught in this fight against things that are uncomfortable.
It's also acknowledging it. And that's a good thing rather than suppressing it or suppressing anger or frustration or rage, because that'll come out later. Whereas if you lean into it, it means that you're working with it in the moment.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess instead of kind of that idea of like having a bottle of Coke and each time something happens, the bottle of Coke just gets shaken and shaken a bit more and eventually explodes. It's about in leaning in, you kind of almost acknowledging in that moment and releasing some of that pressure each moment. I've found over life, I have tended to be that people pleaser and trying to smooth the waters out and not have arguments and not cause conflict. But what that's probably meant is that underneath the surface, lots of that stuff kind of keeps bubbling and bottling away. And so finding ways of kind of acknowledging that actually it is okay to have little bits of conflict, or it is okay to set my boundaries, then starts to make those changes rather than it all building up and eventually exploding or imploding as well.
With you having PND twice, what do you think have been the best strategies that have helped you apart from leaning into discomfort? Has there been something else that stood out for you that you could share?
Both times I actually have ended up taking antidepressant medication. First time around, it was kind of with a severe lack of sleep. Then the second time, it's kind of going, okay, I know there's all these things I should be or could be doing, but my actual capacity in terms of the time I have available, it was needing to take the medication as really a stepping stone to help me get to that point where I could put the strategies into action. Then it is a lot of those kind of small day-to-day things, a bit of a gratitude practice. I often try and just keep a daily journal where at the end of each day I write down a couple of things each day. Sometimes it's a bit of event of what's happened, and then writing down two or three things each day that I'm grateful for. And I often find it's the times where I struggle to see or think of something that are probably the times where it's most important to do that. And really just that practice, like you said, with leaning in, it's about being present in the moment. And that's probably something as a constant reminder of, rather than getting stuck in my head and having an argument in my mind with my husband over something that might only be happening tomorrow or might have happened 3 days ago, actually just stopping and being present in the moment and seeing it for what it is. Sometimes good, sometimes bad. Just being in that moment, I think.
Yeah, definitely. You mentioned being a high achiever. Do you think that that serves you well during these intense times, or have you learned to show yourself some compassion and step back when things get a little bit too much?
I think it's definitely been a learning curve in starting to let go some of those high standards. That was probably a catch this time around after having Darcy. He was quite settled as a baby. And so because I had the award in the background in the first few months, I was doing online training while I was feeding and trying to do so much. And I got to a point where my brain just wasn't working. And I realized that actually those first 3 to 6 months are just as much about mum's recovery as they are about the baby. But it was that real step back. And I think it's really hard. I find it hard to recognize the daily successes of motherhood, like keeping small humans alive and fed and clean and changed. We find it really hard to recognize them as achievements compared to career goals or workplace goals and things. So it's that sometimes having to take a step back and go, actually getting that load of washing done today, that was an achievement, and that's okay as well.
Absolutely. And making the bed is an achievement, and putting on a load of washing is an achievement. All of those really basic things. I remember when my daughter was really young, and if things didn't go well in the day, I would go, okay, come 7 o'clock, because that was her bedtime then, come 7 o'clock, I know that tomorrow's another day. And I've got another opportunity to have a good day.
Yeah.
If things, especially if things didn't work out well that day. I just found the thought process of tomorrow's another day. It starts again. I've got another chance to be productive or just to have a good day. And that really helped my psychology in being a mum.
I think that's probably something my husband's excellent at reminding me on, because I sometimes get hooked up on everything being a disaster. And with three high energy boys as well, sometimes we have really tough times and he'll go, right, we just start again tomorrow. Tomorrow's another day to try again. So he probably keeps me in check with that one. I think it's remembering that it's just those small steps as well. Something I'm working on much more is that we just have to do small things. So for me, it's trying to do two sun salutations in the morning is kind of my daily exercise almost. And I often even don't get that done. But I then remembering that actually I can do that in the time it takes for the kettle to boil for that cup of tea, or that I don't have to set a goal for doing half an hour of exercise a day because that's not feasible, but just doing small moments here and there in whatever thing they might be, that can be the most powerful thing.
You mentioned previously even showing up when you're feeling like you're failing and whilst you're in the depths of postnatal depression as being courageous. Apart from being enough, what else have you learned about yourself?
Oh, I'd forgotten I wrote that. That's an important reminder. Yeah. I think definitely that reminder links back again to the high achiever, that reminder of just by being here, just being alive, basically, that you're worthy enough, that you are enough, that ticking off everything on the to-do list isn't actually necessary to prove anything to everyone else. And I think also for me, it's been acknowledging or learning that expectations don't necessarily serve us that well. I guess for me, my life is very different than what I probably expected if I went back 15 years ago or so. Even just the day-to-day things of what a family might do on a weekend. We don't do I grew up in the city, so we'd go for a bike ride together or you'd go to the shops together. Whereas for us, it's we'll go out and shift a mob of sheep together, or it'll be doing odd jobs here and there. And for me, it's been learning that if I let go of those expectations, life can actually be pretty great. And that practice of going with the flow, even though it doesn't come naturally to me.
Most people don't live on a farm. You live on a farm, it's 10,000 acres, you have sheep and you have cropping, and all of that comes with its daily routine, right, and management. So you've got that plus a family and your work. That's huge. When you think of all of that from a mental health perspective, how do you balance that? Is that something that you feel like you're still learning?
Yes, definitely. And probably learning and remembering that it's okay to stop sometimes as well. So particularly like end of last year, beginning of this year, when I was probably really struggling a lot more, it was literally going, okay, just put on Netflix and watch a few episodes of something for the afternoon and that's okay. I was listening to audiobooks and driving, even while I've still got a small baby and when I'm taking the kids to school, I'd be listening to Atomic Habits or 7 Steps to Change Your Life or various things. And I just went, hang on a second, Steph, this is crazy. Like your brain doesn't have capacity to do all of this. So instead listening to things like Bridgerton or fiction books. So for me, it's that balance, because what I've found is that my own work, finding ways to pursue my own passion is really important. We definitely would have more than enough work for me just to be on the farm full time. But it really is that balance. I'm a better mum, a better wife, all of that, when I know that I will go out and do something for myself, or being able to immerse myself in learning around what's really important to me. But it's still a constant struggle to find the flow. I think there's not really ever a balance in there. It's not that I can say, right, 30% of life to this and 30% of life to that. Doesn't work out in that way. And also acknowledging that that's okay as well. And I think for us, it's been going, okay, where are our weak points and what can we do to build a team? So getting a cleaner who's actually now hopefully going to turn more into a housekeeper kind of mother's help thing, in a way of helping me out with the kids a bit more so that I can pursue my ideas with my project. Even for me, it's acknowledging that that's okay as well. My expectations that I can be perfect mum, perfect wife, perfect business owner, all of that, it's just not possible. And that's not me failing. That's just the expectations are unrealistic.
It's almost like societal expectation, and then we tend to put those labels on ourselves when it's almost impossible. It's putting that self-imposed pressure on yourself. I think imperfection is a better thing to aim for, because you're doing it, you know what I mean? Yeah. You're doing it, you're stumbling along and you're learning as you go along. I love the fact that you gave yourself permission to just flop out on the couch and binge on Netflix a little bit, and that allows for the brain to rest and have that space for creativity to come back, because that's what we all need in order to flourish. It's that spaciousness of mind.
Yeah, absolutely. For me, it's been practicing finding ways of switching off. And if the boys say, oh, mum, come and watch us play, of actually going, oh, yeah, that is okay, just to go and sit outside with them or play with them and kick the football with them, that we don't have to be busy doing all of the time that practice, that we can just be. But it's probably sometimes hard to let go of all those agendas and the to-do list and just practice being in the moment as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, let's move along now to your role as a psychologist in a rural setting. Do you think there are increased mental health problems in rural or remote areas? Are you seeing this?
I think the challenges have been there, or probably always been there in ways. I think there's increased awareness, which is excellent. People are starting to recognise what these symptoms of depression or symptoms of stress and things can look like. But I think also there's no denying that climate change is real and is happening, and it is rural communities that bear the brunt. So even just the last 2 years, we can see that the impact of the drought and the floods and the fires, and it is that these are borne by the rural communities. So that pressure is there. And I guess, like we were talking about at the start, the services, there is a constant challenge in having access to services as well. And what I see is that face-to-face services, if they're available, the wait lists are often just much too long. And while there is the increased telehealth services, which is fantastic, again, it's not necessarily for everyone, or even as we discovered with trying to get the podcast going, there's internet issues and technical issues that come up as well. So there are a lot of challenges there.
You mentioned pressure that comes from the result of fires and droughts. How do they manifest in communities? Is it individual depression or anxiety, or is it community depression and community-based anxiety? What does that look like?
That's a really interesting way of putting it. Different natural disasters almost play out in different ways. So often we see after the fires or the floods, those really kind of acute crisis type disasters, you see kind of communities pulling together. But what I noticed even personally for us, and what I've heard from other people, is that often during the drought, it was more everyone separating and people aren't doing as much socially. And then this was then over the last year impacted even more by COVID. So socializing wasn't an option either. Communities did become quite separate. So now this year, it's really been about working on rebuilding those communities back in. So I think it is a bit of both. And I guess the hard thing is, say with drought, the impact isn't often as visible as a fire or a flood. So each farmer, each member, each family is impacted in different ways. And so it was a lot of kind of having to remind people that we don't know what's going on behind the scenes for anybody else. We don't know the level of other people's debts, or we don't know what their different financial situations are. So I think there's a real need to build that community compassion of care and looking out for each other.
There's a workshop right there, community compassion. You work for a non-government organisation, and that focuses on providing psychological interventions for kids, teens and adults. What are some of these interventions that you offer?
The focus is on providing brief therapy and all evidence-based, so often around cognitive and behavioural therapy or acceptance and commitment therapy are, I guess, a few of my approaches that I really use, and particularly acceptance and commitment therapy is around building those abilities to be in the present moment, be flexible and start to adapt choices and our behaviours of what we do, more so than really trying to focus on changing our thoughts and feelings. It's more recognising that we don't always have a lot of control over our thoughts and feelings. Instead, what we can control is how we relate to them. So if a thought of I'm not good enough comes up, instead of getting really hooked into that, we can step back and get some space from it. And then once we've got some space from it, we can choose to take action on what's most important to us, kind of regardless of what that commentary in the back of our mind is telling us.
It's interesting, you created a rural resilience workshop programs for farmers to equip them with resilient skills to deal with natural disasters like drought, right? And if I understand this correctly, that was part of winning that South Australia's Agri-Future Rural Women's Award, is that right?
Yes, yeah. So the way the awards run is basically as part of the award application, it's really around a project, pitching a project. So my idea was to develop a program around building these skills in resilience or psychological flexibility. Initially what I developed, and I actually ran out a pilot of this via Zoom last year, was 3 1.5-hour workshops with a group of farmers kind of from across South Australia. It went off really well, but what I found from that, and as I've continued talking to people, is that in order to kind of meet this really ground level need that I'm aiming at meeting, is that even 4.5 hours isn't actually brief enough, that what we need is something even shorter. What I'm now working on and trying to do is almost like a 45-minute, 1-hour taster session, I guess, that can be run alongside either like just at a general grower meeting or as a kind of community session, but also at farm information days where they might have someone speaking on livestock and grain production or all those different things, because I kind of go, well, our well-being is just as important in our business as well. And so what I'm looking at is really having a brief session where they actually walk away with a couple of tools and then continuing brainstorming, whether it's then an actual physical handbook that goes along with that. Population will still take on a physical handbook as the farming or the rural population, or also just some online resources. So basically people walk away with some tools in their pocket instead of trying to get people to take part in full day or a half day workshop, but then also being able to have that more in-depth training available to people if they kind of go, actually, no, I'd like to build these skills further as well.
When you spoke earlier on separation, as you were talking about that, I was thinking that equated to possibly people isolating themselves or withdrawing, mm-hmm. you know, when you've gone through major issues or major natural disasters like fires and droughts, and then you've also got COVID on top of that. And I guess the thing here is not to forget to reach out, because in those situations, a lot of people are going through suffering and perhaps coming together and knowing that perhaps you can't do anything to assist each other, you know, with giving maybe food or clothing because you don't have that either. But you've got yourself, you've got each other, you can give each other a hug. Mm-hmm. You know, that's so simple. That's something that you can still give to someone in time of pain or suffering. And just to say to people, you can actually reach out.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's where I see it as being able to provide almost a toolkit so that we have some tools for helping others as well. I think there has been this push, which has been really great, on helping out your mates. But so often when I talk to people, they kind of get stumped and they go, well, yes, I want to help others, but I don't know exactly how to do that or what I should do. We tell people, well, refer them to this phone number. But what I'd love to see is that everyone just has some shared language, shared tools to be able to connect with other people, so that if you see your husband struggling or your friend struggling, to just be able to sit alongside them and listen to them. And then also to be able to go, look, hey, I heard about this perspective. Would you like me to share it with you? We might be able to work out a few steps to take from here, or something along those lines, so that people don't feel so unable to help each other as well.
You and your husband experienced drought on the farm for 2.5 years. Is that actually what prompted you to create the program or even apply for the award?
I think it was. It was, well, one, the practical side, in that being in drought meant that a cropping program was actually a bit smaller than what it normally would be. So he was around a little bit more. So I went, oh, I've got a few minutes spare. I'll just do some extra things to take on this time. But also recognizing that I did have this unique perspective of both my knowledge as a psychologist, but also what it was actually really like to live those years. We built our farm up really ourselves. So that knowledge of what it's like to have a pretty big debt hanging over your head as you go through drought and the pressures of living that. And so trying to find a way of combining all of that knowledge and then being able to get it out there to others.
As part of your program, have you included debt? Because that is definitely an important part of learning how to navigate that as an outcome of a natural disaster.
It's not going into specific issues, but what we're looking at is having some kind of individual resource pages. But it's really almost like a four-step question where you go through and look at what's most important to me. What would I be doing in the world if I was moving towards what was most important to me? But then on the other side of that, okay, as I try and do that stuff, what's all of the things that show up inside of my mind that tend to kind of hook me or get me away from those things? And when I do get hooked inside of my mind, what are the things that I tend to do to avoid that discomfort or get away from it? And so debt's definitely a place where that can show up, because it might be that being able to work towards owning our farm is something that's really important to us as a couple. But when I get hooked up on thoughts around we're never going to pay for this, or the drought's never going to end, or this is all too hard, that might be when you kind of get hooked into unhelpful behaviours such as drinking more or fighting or all of those things. But if you can kind of look at, okay, well, what's most important to us working towards having a successful farm, what are the steps I can do to work towards that? It might be working on having a regular farm meeting. So it's really a way of breaking down into some quite concrete steps, but also putting it on paper, literally, because it is working through this on a blank piece of paper with people, but literally putting it out there. This is the tough stuff that comes up, and that's okay. That's human nature for these difficult thoughts and feelings to come up. But what we get to do by having awareness and being able to notice what's going on, we then get to choose whether we're going to get hooked into unhelpful behaviours of conflict or drinking or eating more chocolate or whatever it might be, or whether we want to take steps towards our values and take steps towards spending time with our kids. So it's starting to help people see those options.
I could certainly see that, the initial brainstorming happening and then practical outcomes. I see that as being an important part of this particular resilience skill building process that sounds like you're trying to create.
Yeah, definitely. It's very much this emphasis on small steps, like I was saying about for myself personally, that we don't have to make huge life-changing steps each day. It might just be one tiny tweak each day that starts to actually set the ball in motion.
Earlier you spoke about the phrase skills in psychological flexibility.
Yeah.
I really like that. Can you just flesh that out a bit more?
Yeah, sure. So psychological flexibility is a bit of a psychojargon term that's come out in probably the last 10, 15 years, but it's found to be a core set of skills that are really related to improved well-being, improved capacity for managing stress, improved workplaces. So across a whole range of areas, but what's most important is it's actually a set of skills that can be taught and trained. It's not an innate concept, and it's this idea of being able to flexibly adapt and choose our behaviours in a given moment based on our values rather than on those inner stories based on our feelings. So instead of getting hijacked by our mind or the feelings and things that come up, which tend to take us away from what's important to us, we can kind of be in this moment, practice being non-judgmental towards ourselves as well, and then really kind of just step in and flexibly adapt and choose what we do next.
I certainly see that being an invaluable phrase to put into your workshop, especially at that community level for resilience. It seems like it would fit in very nicely.
What I see, farmers in particular, and I think rural people as well, are flexible and do adapt and change so often. But sometimes what might happen is we're kind of flexible on the outside. So we might change what we're doing, but on the inside, we're kind of getting really caught and rigid against, or it shouldn't be like this, or this isn't fair, or it should be easier than this. And so it's about kind of getting these conversations out there that we can have challenging situations and need to change, but we can start to be flexible about that. And really at that same time, we can be thrown into tough situations and still be able to have a rich and meaningful life at the same time, if that makes sense.
It does. It absolutely does. It's about mindset awareness, isn't it? I was interviewing someone recently and they talk about flexibility like bending bamboo. And as you're speaking, I'm getting that image. Different jargon, but to me, it's the same outcome, because you want that mindset flexibility, adaptability, which to me equates to resilience.
Yeah, absolutely.
Moving along, you describe your grandmothers as being courageous. Why is this?
They both had different journeys, but I kind of look back on what they did when they were, well, my age, but also a lot younger as well. My nana, my mum's mum, she came out to Australia, I think when she was only in her early 20s. My papa came out with his family and she wanted to follow him. Her dad didn't give her permission to come out, but she came out anyway. And I just look at that, being able to get on a boat to go to the other side of the world, not knowing when you'll actually see your own family again. It was just a huge amount of courage and a lot of conviction around wanting to do what was right for her. She had three kids under three, and again, doing that fairly well on her own without any family support around as well. And she is someone who's always been able to find joy through life as well. She's 92 now, but she's off on a boat cruise this weekend on the Murray River. She's an absolute gem.
That's amazing. There is a real sense of grit, isn't there, for people who have done that. My father hopped on a plane and left his family behind. And you're right, just to sit back and just reflect on what migrants do when they leave their homeland. They leave everything and everyone behind to create a new life for themselves. That is definitely courageous. There's so much in that, isn't there?
Yeah.
It's not just the boat trip or the plane ride. It's everything that comes after that and also before that.
Yeah, absolutely, which is what it was for my dad's mum. So she was, again, in kind of World War Two and was in Ukraine. It's always been a bit unclear because of the changing country boundaries. We always thought she was Russian, but then kind of found out she was actually from Ukraine. And throughout the war, I think she was only a teenager and she had to leave her home. And then at one point she was on a train heading back and could hear, she spoke multiple languages. She was fluent in Russian, German, was remarkable with languages, but she heard the soldiers talking about what they were going to do to this train of young women when they got to the destination. So she jumped out of the train and then made her way and eventually got to a refugee camp and then came to Australia, but as a refugee rather than a migrant. Her situation was very much forced and out of lack of choice, but again, a very tough woman who got through remarkable things.
So what do you see in yourself that you have seen in your grandmothers?
A fair bit of stubbornness, also known as determination, that comes in there. But for me, it's been finding that as I've gotten older. When I talked to my nana and she was saying about how her dad didn't give her permission, but she went, well, I'm just leaving anyway. I couldn't have imagined doing that as a teenager or even in my early 20s, whereas now I'm kind of going, actually, no, it's okay. It's all right to put my foot down for what is right for me. And then the reminders of just being able to find that joy in the small things as well. Power of determination is an important one.
So it runs through the female side then.
Fortunately, once we get to the other side of child raising, but it's fairly strong in both mine and my husband's side. So what it means is we've got three very strong, determined young boys at the moment. But it's one of those things I like to hope serve them well once they're older, but we just have to survive it through their childhood.
Absolutely. Yes, determination equals grit, perseverance.
Yeah.
So that they're all byproducts of courage. So that's good. And on that note, is it possible for you to define courage for me?
For me, it's showing up even when you think you can't.
Yeah, that's simple. I think rather concise. So with that definition, are you courageous?
Yes, I think so. I'm learning to acknowledge that I probably am, as much as I often tell myself that I'm not. But I think there's been a lot of journeys. And like you said, when you actually put it on paper and look at all the things that I have done, I actually know to get to some of these places, it's taken a fair bit of courage to do that. And owning it is okay as well. Owning up to having courage is a pretty cool thing as well.
Thank you so much for sharing your insights on Courage Unraveled today, Steph. It's been fantastic. And I look forward to having a chat with you again another time.
Yeah, thank you so much. It's been great.
There's a lot to navigate rurally. The lack of basic services that folks in the city take for granted, travelling long distance to access services, the threat of natural disasters, as well as its aftermath. Steph Schmidt deals with all of it on a daily basis and is honest with herself when she finds that there are times when things are not okay, and that's okay. And you know what? That's half the battle. Looking at yourself in the mirror and being honest when things are personally not going well, and then taking the step to seek professional support. To me, that's courage. Steph has used her challenges to fuel community resilience, and in doing so, is making a difference in her community. She is an example of courage. Thank you for your contribution to your community, Steph. Jump onto courageunraveled.com/podcasts, Series 5, Episode 29, to find out how to contact Steph. Thank you for listening to Courage Unraveled. If you like what you hear, please leave a review via Google or your favourite listening platform. The link can be found where you find each episode on the website. Finally, for courage coaching, group mindset coaching, or if you're in the need of a courage keynote speaker, please send me an email via the website. I'm Sana Turnock, your Courage Unraveled host. Until next time.